Welcome to Minion Podcast Episode 2. Last week, you may remember that I had Andrew Brisgornia on with me. This week, I have TJ Gorsigner, also from Twinkie Town. And I'm glad to meet with you, TJ.
Thanks, Aiden. I'm glad you have me on here. And by the way, nice job with the pronunciation. Most people butcher the name. You were pretty darn close there.
Oh, what do you get? Is it like Gorsigner or what?
I get a lot of Gorsinger. It's actually Gorsigner.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, but
that's what I assumed.
Super, super common to have that mispronounced, but nice job on that one.
Yeah, I just said it how it looks phonetically. And yeah. So I wanted to talk about the Nelson Cruz signing. Specifically, well, this is old news by now, but Twins signed Nelson Cruz to a 1-year, $14 million deal, and there's been a lot of talking about why this happened, but there has been some new developments that have come out, specifically Jonathan Scope sort of recruited Cruz to come here, or rather Scope tried to get the Twins to get Cruz because they had played together and he worked very well in Baltimore with Scope and Machado too. That's what the article said. That's in the Pioneer Press.
Absolutely. And I think the money quote in that article comes from Levine. And he states that Scope was heavily recruiting the front office to sign Nelson Cruz due to the impact that Cruz had on both Scope and on Manny Machado when the three of them were playing together in Baltimore. And I definitely think that's something that the Twins have been looking for this offseason, is not just high character players, but players who can really step up, be that leader, be that mentor to some of the younger players on the team.
Yeah, and I mean, the Twins are so built around Sano, Buxton, Rosario, Kepler, just those four, really. And it's kind of, if the young players aren't stepping up, then the whole team is going to be down.
Absolutely agree with you. I think, I really think that Rosario and Kepler on their own, they're both very nice players, nice assets for a team, but neither one of them is going to be the guy that's going to carry the team. I really think that getting the most out of Buxton and the most out of Sano is going to be the difference maker for the Twins. The other day we posted on Twinkie Town a post talking about how the most important move the Twins made this offseason was primarily in the relationship between Rocco Baldelli and Miguel Sano. And I definitely, that kind of resonates a little bit in the essentially acquiring Sano at his best is really the equivalent of acquiring yet another player, you know?
That came from Zach Koenig, correct?
Yeah, that was Zach's post on Friday that went up, but it was definitely something that really caught my attention. I hadn't quite noticed as much as maybe I had how much of an impact that could make on the team.
Yeah, and we do, like, there's some really good analysis. Well, I think building team chemistry is the most important thing. That's probably one of the big reasons why the move was made.
Another thing that I think it does do too, that team chemistry thing being so important, but it's the Twins sending a signal to the world. Everyone out there knows Nelson Cruz is not going to be playing the field. He's going to be your DH. So to me, that really is the Twins sending a message both to fans, to the baseball world, but also to Miguel Sano, that Sano is their guy at third base. They're going to ride with him, especially since they don't have anyone else on the team who's got any experience. I think Jorge Polanco has played like 15 games at third base in his entire major league career. Adrianza's played a little handful. Scope's played a handful, but nobody has even anything worth calling experience at third base. So they are tied with Sano, or they've got no other choice. You know, I mean, it's Sano or nothing in terms of players that have any experience at third base right now. Williams Astudillo is still somehow listed as the number one third baseman on their depth chart.
And we're going to talk about Williams Astudillo later because I feel like we have to. Because there was some big news involving him as well. So Sano is capable at third base. He's shown that. And
I think you're on the right track in saying that he's capable. And I think a lot of people outside of kind of the Twins sphere here, you know, we as Twins fans, we give him credit, but a lot of people don't. That was a lot of the reaction. If you saw the Grant Brisby article a couple weeks back about the Cruz signing, he said that's a weird fit because essentially where's Sano going to play? He can't play third. I mean, we see that, but a lot of people in the baseball world, I think, will be a little surprised if Sano meets that potential at third base.
I mean, I actually did reference Brisby's piece in something that I wrote about the Cruz signing, where I was just kind of rounding up reactions from around the world of baseball. And you may remember that I listed it as a warm take. Because it wasn't quite a hot take. It wasn't super reasonable as well. So I just kind of put it in the middle.
I think that's a good way to sum up kind of the world that Grant's in over there, where he, you know, he's not necessarily the most plugged into the Twins. So he's got those hot takes, but they're usually, you know, not extreme either. So I definitely think you're kind of, you're summing that up pretty well with that.
Do you recall when he tweeted out a couple of years back, if the Twins make the playoffs, and they did that year, that was the year that they made the wild card game, he would write fan fiction about Joe Mauer's Twins going to a summer camp and fighting an evil camp counselor or something like that. And then I uncovered it, and it turns out that he was like, no, that was just if they won the division. And so he never actually did it. But he still owes us that, I think.
That's a shame. That's definitely an article I'd like to see. You know, more Joe Mauer satire, more Joe Mauer fan fiction in this world is always a good thing.
If it's not Rand Ball Stew doing it, I don't know if it would be that good.
Hey now. I've written my share of Joe Mauer satire.
Yeah, you have, but Stu is on a whole nother level of Joe Mauer impersonations.
No, just that's just fantastic for sure.
Yeah, I thought it was funny because he was like, "Please don't hold me to this because it's going to happen, and then I'm going to have to do it, and I don't want to do it." That just kind of shows that he doesn't really want to really have to pay attention to the Twins, because he wrote an article earlier that season where he was like, I really don't want to be writing about the Twins in September. Yeah, I mean, they just kind of want the Twins to be there and don't have to pay attention to them. And it's really unfortunate, but that's kind of the way it's been for years now, ever since they've been bad, at least, or less good.
Yeah. I mean, even when the Twins were good back in the early half of the 2000s, they definitely didn't get that same level of recognition, same level of notice. I mean, you can attribute it to a coastal bias. You can attribute it to the fact that the Twins are a small market team. It doesn't really matter why, but it's definitely it's a fact that, you know, media coverage is a little different most of the time. Although, like you mentioned, when we get into Williams Astudillo, I think he might have the power to change some things as far as media
The
coverage goes.
power of Williams Astudillo.
That's if it's a site that talks about sports, they're probably talking about Williams right now, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, so in that, ESPN actually wrote a piece about him, about, so he hit that majestic dinger in the Winter League. I don't know which Winter League it was.
Venezuelan.
Okay, that's what I thought. But yeah, he's kind of forcing people to pay attention to the Twins, like, to your point.
I think the biggest thing about Astudillo that people love is just that he's having fun. You know, baseball is a business in a lot of ways, and a lot of these guys are either difficult to cheer for. You get a Trevor Bauer or a Addison Russell or somebody, and they're just difficult to cheer for. Or you get guys who are, you know, very professional and maybe very, very good people, but they're just a little boring. Astudillo is just the opposite. He is what every kid in Little League dreams of being, as a, you know, if they can grow up to be a big leaguer. The man doesn't strike out. He doesn't take walks. He puts the ball in play. He hustles. And when he hits majestic dingers, he takes a knee and watches him fly out of the park.
He's pretty much breaking every single unwritten rule. And I think that's amazing. Like, the, you don't do this, you don't flip your bat, you don't, like, do you remember that MLB postseason commercial with Ken Griffey Jr. and where Major League Baseball was like, we're sorry for being jerks about what you can and can't do? Like, don't.
And that's.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's definitely one of the things that the Latin leagues are known for. You know, Venezuelan, Dominican, anywhere in the Caribbean series, you're going to see players playing with a lot more passion and a lot of, you know, a lot more emotion, where you see the bat flips and some of those things that do violate some of those so-called unwritten rules of Major League Baseball.
We talked about, Briz and I talked about last week, former baseball players being really, really insufferable when it comes to, like, the modern game and saying, no, you can't change anything. And I think that kind of fits here as well, what we're talking about now.
You know, there's two sides to that. You get a lot of guys, and Bert Blyleven is the perfect example, of course. You know, Bert is often stereotyped as being the back-in-my-day guy. And I definitely – you know, that back in my day doesn't play very well if you weren't around to watch the game back in his day.
Yeah, I mean, you get that with really anything where you're just, you hear people, oh, it was so much better back in the day with music, sports, anything really. Like, they refuse to acknowledge, yeah, there are some good things now, and we should just let it happen.
One for history and tradition and respecting the roots of the game, but at the same time, there is definitely an argument to be made that, you know, as society evolves a little bit, we need to see the game evolve with it. You know, back in the 1920s, you had baseball players who worked other jobs in the off season, who'd sit there and eat hot dogs and smoke cigarettes on the bench. And as society's evolved, and as we've become as the leagues become more professional, you know, the baseball players have changed. And at the same time, you know, we can kind of reflect on that as being a positive, but at the same time, we don't necessarily see the change in the way baseball players celebrate, in the cultures the baseball players come from, as in that same light, as being as positive as some of the lifestyle changes. And it's just a little It's a little odd that that's how we look at it.
Yeah, but and it's also interesting, like, generally we see, like, the old players from, like, way back in the day as, like, the greatest of all time, but, like, for example, in the article about Astudillo and ESPN, they talk about there was this guy who only struck out in his career 6.9% of the time, which, nice, first of all. And second of all, in 1925, which was when this guy was playing, they were throwing like 60 mile an hour fastballs.
Joe Sewell, or Joe, I believe it's Sewell is how that's pronounced, that you're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, the entire league was striking out at a drastically lower rate back then, to where, you know, even if he wasn't striking out, you know, at all, he wasn't as much of an outlier in his career as what Astudillo is, where he is truly unique, because we're in an era of more strikeouts than ever, and more home runs, of course, which he hits those, but more strikeouts than ever, and yet he does not strike out.
Yeah, I mean, he really, like, I'm being genuine here, he's really incomparable to anyone that, like, in the modern era, you know?
I think that's part of what makes him unique as a player and so noteworthy, is he doesn't fit any mold. He just completely breaks away from what a baseball player is. You know, we consider a baseball player to be this or to be that, and meanwhile you've got this short little chubby guy running around doing all the things that baseball players don't do and being successful at it.
Yeah, I mean, he really is remarkable. Just, I'm kind of half joking here, but also, like, he's very special in the way that he plays the game, and I think the Twins are very lucky to have him.
I think one of the other things that makes him very unique, which, again, we see as the Twins fans that have watched all 97 plate appearances he made, but a lot of people who just see the highlights don't realize just how versatile he is in the field. The Twins played him in five or six different positions last season, primarily third base, but also catching, center field. He pitched. I mean, some truly athletic feats.
Yeah.
He looked like Kirby Puckett came back and was running around out there in center field, the old, you know, chubby guy in center field, but there it was.
Yeah. And I mean, the in Chicago, he made his MLB debut in against the Cubs, I believe it was. And just, I think Twitter went pretty crazy after that, because they were like, here's this guy just kind of running around having fun, and he's very different from anyone we've ever seen.
I don't know if you recall last offseason, shortly before the Twins signed Astudillo, Viva Albertos, which is the Cardinals, Cardinals blog on SB Nation, ran an article profiling Astudillo and just how strange of a player he is. And that was really my introduction.
Yeah, I don't believe I've ever read that, but it seemed, I think I might have, after the Twins signed him, I think I might have seen it somewhere, but I don't recall actually reading that. Was he ever with the Cardinals at any point? Is that why the Cardinals
signed? I don't think so. I'm going to have to look that up real quick here, but they were, I believe, advocating for the Cardinals to sign him as, you know, as the unique player that he is. Let's see. I got to get Baseball Reference pulled up here, and I'll tell you exactly who he played for. So Astudillo played in the Phillies organization primarily, it looks like. Also spent a year with Atlanta and a year with Arizona before making it to Minnesota.
That's so he was a journeyman too. He's kind of gone around a little bit.
Absolutely. So it looks like he's he's been in professional baseball since he was a 17-year-old, back in 2009.
Jeez.
Yeah, so he's been a minor league free agent, of course, been available for any team to snap up, and nobody has promoted him to the major leagues until Minnesota did. But obviously, there was something teams like because he's kind of made his rounds around baseball.
Yeah, and I'm just back to the sign when he was 17. I'm 18, and whenever somebody younger than me does something crazy like that, or somebody that was younger than me is at a professional level in anything, is that's crazy. It doesn't really add up because they're still a kid and then they are thrust into the situation at a really young age.
Wait until you get older. Half of Major League Baseball is younger than I am right now. It doesn't get any less weird. It just becomes a little more normal at the same time.
Yeah, and Juan Soto, Ronald Acuna, and then there was a guy that the Rays, I think, signed a few weeks ago. He was born in 2002.
I'm shaking my head at you right now because you're playing the old man card on me here, but I'm playing the same card on you mostly,
Yeah, and no, I'm just saying that for somehow I feel old thinking about that. I shouldn't. I really shouldn't, but at the same time, it's like, how are there people this young, this good at baseball?
It really amazes me sometimes. You get somebody, I'm gonna pick on you a little bit here. You get somebody like you that's you said you're 18.
Yes.
I mean, do you even remember when the Twins were good? It's kind of it's strange how bad they've been for how long, how quickly, because I still feel like we're not that far apart from, the early 2000s Mauer and Morneau teams that were consistent playoff threats, even if they didn't do anything in the playoffs, they were consistently there.
I don't know if you recall when Joe Mauer retired, I wrote something for Twinkie Town about the impact that he's had on my baseball watching career, I guess. Do you remember reading that?
I do, and I think at the time, but I think Joe Mauer had a similar impact on your fandom to what Kirby Puckett had on those of us a few years older. So Kirby Puckett being the first hero, I've told the story a few times, I think, but I remember back in T-ball, kindergarten, first grade, something like that. The coach gathered the whole team around and says, "Hey, what position do you want to play and why?" And that was my answer. I want to be an outfielder. That's where Kirby Puckett plays. And I think Joe Mauer is a similar kind of influence on those of you that are just a little bit younger and maybe don't remember Kirby Puckett or don't remember Kirby Puckett before some of the unsavory things came out after his retirement.
Yeah.
But he meant the same thing to a lot of us as kids as what Joe Mauer means to a lot of folks.
And if you'll recall, I introduced that piece. The first Twins game I ever went to was the one where they clinched the 2006 AL Central title. and that was at the Dome. And I had already been following the Twins for a couple of years because, like, that's sort of when you're that young, that's kind of you start following baseball a little bit, but then you just kind of like you don't really know a lot about it yet, you know? And that was really my first time seeing Joe Mauer. And he had such a profound impact on, he retired my entire, yeah, my entire baseball watching life has had Joe Mauer in it.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a different perspective when the players that you grew up with start retiring and all of a sudden there's new players coming in the league that are younger than you are. It shifts your perspective. But I want to kind of circle back a little bit here. One of the things you said that kind of stuck with me, you know, when you're a little younger, you're going to be attracted to the personalities, to the players who are having fun, more than you're just going to look at the numbers and the stats and those kind of things. And I think that's something, as we circle back here, that Williams Astudillo brings to this team, is that passion, that fun, that engagement that the fans, especially younger fans or fans who are newer to the sport, are going to tap into and feed into. And it's really it's something the Twins need, I think, to create a little bit of excitement going into the season. They've lost some big names, some familiar names, after coming off as many losses as they have. There's not a lot of reasons for people to get up and go to a game, especially a March or an April game in Minnesota when the weather might not be conducive. And I think Astudillo kind of brings that, assuming he even makes a major league roster to start the season.
Yeah, and I really hope he does, because he's kind of a meme, and that's – we need – and also he's a really valuable asset. But I understand why they would think that he wouldn't – they would need to make room for somebody else at the same time.
And the biggest thing with that is that he has options. So the Twins could quite easily – you know, keep him down in Rochester, run the old shuttle back and forth, so to speak, treat him as a 26th man on the bench, swap him out with a pitcher as needed, or with another outfielder or another infielder or a player who's better at any one thing, and then always have that option to bring him back after a few more days.
Yeah, and like I play catcher, actually, so I'm definitely going to have to try the no-look pickoff this season. Do you remember that?
Oh, he did it a couple times. He pulled it in spring training on Sugar Shane Robinson. There's a name from the past, by the way. But
that's a blast from the past, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He pulled it off in spring training on Shane Robinson, and then he pulled it off in a game for Rochester as well, I believe.
Yeah, and I'm not exactly I kind of just catch the ball and throw it back. I don't really try to pick people off or anything. But
you got to control that run game. Come on.
Yeah. Actually, there's not you can lead off in wheelchair softball, but you can't steal. So there's not really any running, but there's like, it's really important because when you play catcher, you kind of like control the game. You have to call all like where, here's where you need to throw it. And
absolutely, you're the field general. That's the reason why, if you look at how many MLB managers have major league experience, and in what position? The vast majority are catchers. They're vastly overrepresented because it's kind of a chicken and the egg thing, and several different outlets have looked into it a little bit. But, you know, whether it's that the catchers really have more baseball IQ than most players, or just that they have that reputation. But either way, that is a factor.
Well, yeah, there's not really – catchers are kind of an underrated position, I think.
I think they're crazy. I don't want to stand put my body directly in front of a 100-mile-an-hour projectile repeatedly. But, you know, somebody has to do it, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean – like, imagine catching a role as Chapman or something like that. That would be, like, even crazier than... The dude's throwing, like, 105... If, like, 100-mile-an-hour fastball, I can't imagine trying to catch that.
You know, that was the old joke about knuckleballs. How do you catch a knuckleball? You wait till it stops rolling, and then you pick it up. But, some of these guys with these fastballs, you know, you almost have to do the same thing just for self-preservation. At least I would. I'm sure there's braver souls than I who would be willing to try to catch it. But I like I like my fingers not being broken too much.
Yeah, and I play slow pitch, so it's really not that demanding. But it's still just, we were talking about this earlier, the game is so different from what it was like 50 years ago, because people are throwing faster, they're hitting the ball harder as a result, and then people striking out more. So it's just kind of the same. It's not the same as it was back then. So you can't really say, oh, back in my day or whatnot.
Well, and you have pitchers in much more specialized roles. You have, you know, back in the day, say you had one pitcher who was your starter every day, and he usually went 8 or 9 innings, and then you might have a reliever come in. If you go far enough back, you didn't even have the fireman, you know. It was your pitcher for the day was your pitcher for the day, period. And a guy might throw, you know, 200, 300 pitches. It didn't matter. He was going to keep going until the game ended.
Yeah, that's,
but
that's what Bert Blylevin says all the time. We didn't really have pitch counts. We just kind of, like, threw till our arm fell off or whatever. And that kind of bugs me because it's a very different time now.
And again, that's a chicken and the egg thing a little bit too, where you wonder if the rise of the elbow and the shoulder and the other injuries comes from the fact that the guys are throwing harder and specializing more, or if it's better, you know, better medicine, or exactly why these things are coming in. But, you know, those things are leading into the rise of pitch counts and tracking those kind of things. Because we don't want to see, you know, all these guys getting out with Tommy John and everything else going on.
Yeah, and it's just, it's so much faster. Players are stronger to an extent. And it's not even really comparable to what it was back then, I guess.
Yeah, if you ever watch like some of the town ball things, and I'm not nearly as into that as a lot of the guys, but you watch like a town ball league, it's the game's so very different than what the MLB game is. They have the same fundamental rules, but it's not the same game. It really isn't, and it's not played by the same kind of player.
Yeah, and it's just kind of. So that's what I don't understand about why people are yearning for the olden days, because you can't really go back to that because it's just changed so much.
You know, with people with the nostalgia factor, I think goes deeper than baseball too. You know, there's a lot of things that people are nostalgic for, and we're not going to go very far down the road of where we could go here, but you know, a lot of people are trying to remember another time. I think baseball connects into that for them.
I don't know if you remember this, but a few days ago, I tweeted out a long list of like an article, like only 90s kids will remember this or whatever. And just like how much it bugged me. And this is way off of what we were talking about, but just like, that's kind of in the same vein where you're yearning for the past. And I think that's kind of a big problem when you're not really focused on this is what it is now and here's how we should deal with this. And that was a bit of a, I was going off base there, but I think that's a decent connection. Yeah, and I don't know what people are trying to accomplish by saying that it's, oh, it was so much better back then. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, and I apologize. That technical issues are getting me a little bit here. So just to make sure we're on the same page here, you were saying that that nostalgia really is great, but we have to kind of filter the past through a little bit more of a lens as we look back at it, because we live in a slightly different society and things are different now. Is that correct?
So I'm glad you picked that up.
Yeah, absolutely. So I definitely agree with that. One of the big things I believe in a little bit is that you have to, when you look back, you have to consider the world that you're looking back to on its own, both merits and demerits. You know, certainly 50 years ago, the world was a great place if you fit into certain categories of people. But if you were not a member of some of those groups, you know, you definitely had a lot of disadvantages. And that's something that, you know, as we look back in a baseball perspective, when those unwritten rules were written, you didn't have players from the Latin cultures. You didn't have players from a lot of other cultures who are, you know, more willing to share their emotions about the games. Most of the players, you know, especially as you go back into the segregation era of baseball, you know, they came from a culture and a cultural background where emotion was a little more frowned upon. Whereas when you look through that lens nowadays, it makes a little less sense to ostracize a guy for celebrating a home run, or whatever the case is. So I think that kind of viewing that through the correct lens definitely makes a difference.
Well, I think that's a good place to end it, actually. And I'm glad we could have this conversation. And I thank you for coming on. And we had a lot of this, but it worked out pretty well, I think.
Absolutely, Hayden. And, you know, I'll be glad to talk to you again in the future. Hopefully we have a little bit more a little more cooperation from the technology, but I wish you well with the podcast, man. It's been fun, and hopefully we can talk a little more here somewhere down the road.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks.
You bet. Talk to you later.